Ladies and gentlemen, welcome. My name is Kirk Campbell here at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. I want to warmly welcome all of you to the book launch at CSIS of COBRA 2, and it was really our pleasure to be able to really launch this important book into the world. We had the great pleasure and good fortune of having Michael Gordon with us at CSIS for almost 2 years, and I've worked with General Traynor for many, many years, both at Harvard and subsequently. And so it's wonderful to see good people write an absolutely first-class book. I'm not going to spend a lot of time with introductions. I think these gentlemen are well known to you, but give you a sense of what the evening's going to be like. They're going to speak quickly a little bit about the book, Michael Gordon first, and then General Traynor, and then we'll take a few questions from the audience for the both of them. And then we will open it up for a broader discussion, which I'll quickly and hopefully easily moderate with distinguished guests Dennis Ross, Richard Falkenrath, and Michael O'Hanlon, also well known to all of you about the book. Because this is a book-selling event, we promise that this will go quickly, and I urge and ask all of you to appreciate that both authors will be signing in the back. And so it's great that you're here and enjoying our wine and cocktails, but please appreciate the hard work that went into this book, and both authors are prepared to write nice things to you. So with that, let me ask Michael Gordon to take the stand just to say a little bit about the book and what he hopes to accomplish with it.
Well, I think there are a lot of people here who wondered if I would ever finish this big book, and I think I trashed two offices and went through the number of research assistants, and two of my key research assistants, Christopher Mann and Jeremiah Cushman, are sitting right there, and without them, it's absolutely true we would never have made this project work, because this was a lot of work and it was very intense. The inspiration for this book was really a book that General Traynor and I did 10 years ago, The General's War, and that was a history of the Persian Gulf War, which we worked on for 3 years. So in this case, I think we shaved it to about 2.5. And we had, our goal then at the time was to basically get to the ground truth of that war and to put together the story from the level of the generals to the battlefield and put the two together. So we had a bit of a model to follow for this conflict. And by the summer of 2002, it was obvious to me that there was going to be another war with Iraq. And I began thinking that, that General Traynor and I should build in our contacts and our background and follow through and do yet another book on this conflict. I have to tell you, I had no idea what form the war would take, what would happen. I simply knew that it would be deserving of a book, one that followed in the mold of the General's War. And so when I began thinking about this, I had a discussion here with Kurt. I think we talked in the Starbucks at the Farragut North Metro. I don't think he was interrupted more than 4 or 5 times during that conversation. But we basically agreed that, that CSIS would sponsor this, and that's really what made it possible. So it's thanks to Kurt and John Hamry, and then Bruce Blair picked it up with his institute afterwards, which was very important. I think by the time I approached Bruce, he had almost gotten over all the money he put into my Chechnya War documentary, and he was ready to help out with this one as well. Now, COBRA 2, why that sort of Clancy-esque name? COBRA 2 is actually the name of the land invasion plan. I was asked by a cabinet-level official, I won't say which one, what COBRA 2 was, and I said, well, it's the name of the war plan for the ground. And why COBRA 2? It was, because COBRA 1 was the General Patton's breakout from Normandy, Third Army, and the Third Army was really the nucleus for the Land War Command, which oversaw the invasion of Iraq. And I was one of a handful of correspondents embedded there. Elaine was also another one sitting right there in the row, and we were sort of trying to get a vantage. It was a great place to get a vantage point into how the generals made decisions, and also, very importantly, the interaction between Washington and the generals on the field, because there was a lot of that. And it took another year or two of hard reporting to dig out a lot of the story and access the relevant documents, but it gave me a basis to work from. Now, we set out to tell the story of the whole war, and for us that is not just the policymaking in Washington, as important as that all seems here, it was also the battles themselves. And as a correspondent, I was struck by how little really the American public knows about a lot of the fighting in Iraq during the march to Baghdad, and also how wrong some of the conceptions were. I mean, I think a lot of people think the war was kind of a drive to Baghdad, regime collapses, and then things got hard. But it was hard from the very, very beginning. And they were, because of the nature of the embed process, the fact that it was a fast-moving event, the fact that people were moving on, and it was hard to go back and put it together. I think a lot of these battles really haven't been well documented, but General Traynor and I set out to document and recreate a lot of these battles. What really happened in Nasiriyah? What happened in As-Samawa? What happened at the Kifl Bridge? This was no walk in the park. And there's some people here in this room who fought in those battles, and they were extremely fierce fights with against an enemy that was not really foreseen at the time. A key question, though, that has emerged since the book came out on Tuesday is people want to know, essentially, how we got into our present predicament. And it is a predicament. You know, how has it come to pass that a nation that won such a lightning victory, right, in just a matter of weeks, took down Saddam's regime took Baghdad, is now really caught in a very terribly difficult situation in Iraq with well over 100,000 troops, trying to keep the lid on a situation on a nation that's perched on the edge of civil war. I think there are a number. There's no one reason which explains why this happened. Just like in any complicated human undertaking, it's not explained, too simplistically. I think there are three or four principal factors that, taken together, have contributed to creating this unpleasant situation we confront today. And I want to tick them off, and then I'm going to hand the podium to McTrainer, and he's going to address sort of the Iraqi side of the war and how the war seemed from Iraq when they fought the Americans, which is a really fascinating aspect of the conflict that we were able to get into thanks to some access to some classified materials. The one thing I think, in my three or four reasons as to how we got here, I think that one principal factor is, and I know some people don't agree with this, but I think it's true anyway, that I think that in the design of the war campaign, we essentially fought the last war. And by that I mean the principal enemy that the United States envisioned on the march to Baghdad was the Republican Guard. And the basic concept was you beat the Republican Guard, you take Baghdad, we win. The regime topples, and we put in our own Iraqis, they run the ministries, and we can get out in a relatively short period. There'll be a lingering presence to stabilize the country, but basically we've achieved our victory. I think that this was partly an intelligence failure. I think the CIA reinforced this view, and I think they did the American intelligence community did a very poor job of documenting the threat in the southern Iraq that the forces actually confronted. I think, they placed where all the Republican Guard tanks and vehicles were and where they thought the WMD was that was supposedly going to hit these forces. But what they really didn't see were the things that didn't have icons, that you weren't observable from outer space or from airplanes, which was the presence of thousands of paramilitary fighters in southern Iraq with RPGs and large caches of arms. And, the basic image that the agency presented and American intelligence presented to the forces, our forces, before the war, was that the southern cities were, quote, ours. And in researching this book, the troops were told they should even be prepared for parades, as I think some people can confirm in this room. And not that they would necessarily happen, but they might happen. Parades in the honor of American forces. There was even a scheme at one point to distribute tiny American flags throughout southern Iraq so they could wave at the American forces, and they could take a photograph of this, and it would be a big information op. And that was sort of the capitulation scenario that a lot of people were led to expect. Well, it didn't happen that way. When American forces crossed into Iraq, they were from the very beginning, they were involved in fighting this irregular foe, didn't wear uniforms, decentralized command and control in Nasiriyah, Samawa, An-Najaf, all of these places. And it was a big wake-up call for the forces, but I think the forces adjusted pretty well to this, the Army and the Marines. But they're still, at higher headquarters, by which I mean the Department of Defense and the Central Command leadership, there was a tendency to see the Republican Guard as really the sole principal threat, and not to take the full measure of what was happening on the battlefield. Even then, despite these fights against this irregular adversary, there was a tendency at CENTCOM and I think back at the Pentagon to say, these guys are just a speed bump, they're just a distraction, keep the pedal to the metal, keep going, get to Baghdad, the war will be over. And I think this was a kind of a fundamental, again, misreading of the battlefield, and I'll tell you one consequence that it had. As the forces were approaching to Baghdad, Secretary Rumsfeld raised the issue of, quote, off-ramping the 1st Cavalry Division, raised it rather insistently. And, why do we really need this division? And General Franks initially made the case for it, but he eventually came to the conclusion it wasn't needed. So at a time when our forces are fighting a foe that we hadn't anticipated and which really had not really been defeated so much as gone to ground and was being bypassed, the leadership was reducing the number of forces in the plan, not adding to it. And I think that reflects a misreading of the situation on the ground. And I have to say, there are people who warned of this in the sense that they at least alerted the leadership that there was a different type of adversary there. There was a Marine intelligence officer in Nasiriyah who said the Fedayeen is a threat that's not going to go away. We're bypassing him. We're going to have to deal with him later. Well, that's not the kind of a conclusion they came to at the higher levels. I think a second major factor that contributes to the situation we have today is kind of an aversion to nation building as an enterprise on the part of the White House and the Bush administration. Even before the Bush administration took office, I was interviewing Condoleezza Rice, people like that. They're saying, we're not going to do this Clinton-style nation building. We're not going to do this Bosnia stuff. That's going to be for the Allies. We're just going to do major war fighting. We're going to not get tied down in this sort of thing. Well, this was a very prevalent attitude. Secretary Rumsfeld gave a speech on this a month before the war called Beyond Nation Building. And the basic notion was that after we topple this regime in Baghdad, instead of a long presence with a large number of troops and a kind of an international civil service to control things, we were going to transfer responsibility as quickly as possible to the Iraqis and implication also get out as quickly as possible. And I think they were partly seduced into this by their early experience in Afghanistan, where they essentially did this and kind of got away with it, although if you look at Afghanistan today, one might wonder if they're perhaps, it wouldn't have been wiser to take the nation-building problems a little more seriously. But I think this was an attitude, and what it meant was that in looking towards Phase 4, the post-war operations, they didn't really want to resource what do we do about the electrical grid? What do we do about the infrastructure? And a lot of people think these are errors of omission. It's like they forgot to do this or they didn't get to it. No, these are errors of commission. This is a policy that they had and implemented. It's not like they forgot that there would be a problem of law and order in Baghdad. It was raised by mid-level officials in the Justice Department who said we need 5,000 international civilian police. And that issue went to the White House, and the White House said, we are not sending these people. We're going to rely on the Iraqi police because we want them to be in charge. That was a perfectly good strategy on the assumption the Iraqi police were competent and didn't run away. What was the backup plan if the Iraqi police didn't hold? There wasn't one. So I think the second factor was an aversion to nation building. And a third factor, and then I'm going to hand over to Mick, that I think made a very difficult situation worse, was the ill-advised decision by Ambassador Bremer to dissolve the Iraqi military and essentially try to run Iraq as the viceroy of the country. And, you know, this is a decision, he has an account of it in his book, but I find that account is incomplete. This is a decision was taken against, really, the advice and counsel of the U.S. military. I was with the U.S. military. And the plan that they went in with was to basically work with the Iraqi army, retrain them, keep the Iraqi army. It's the plan, by the way, that was briefed to the president, and he thought that was the plan going in, and use them as a source of, provide security for the country, as a source of labor. That was the plan. And General McKiernan, with whom I was embedded, and the CIA station chief, was meeting with Iraqi generals to try to recall them. Sure, the Iraqi army went AWOL. The plan was to bring them back. There was every indication they were prepared to come back. They came back later for their pay. And that was the plan when Ambassador Bremer arrived, and with a decision to disestablish the Iraqi army and build a new one over a very, very slow period. And it was a what the consequence of that is having misread the battlefield and not appreciated the significance of the Fedayeen, which provided an indication that when Baghdad fell, maybe there would be another element out there that you might have to deal with, and having off-ramped the 1st Cavalry Division, there was a limited number of U.S. troops. And then Ambassador Bremer comes in and says, well, it disbands the Iraqi army. We don't need them. And now there's a very limited number of Iraqi troops. We have a limited number of American troops, a limited number of Iraqi troops. You put the two together, what you really have is a security vacuum. And it was a perfect environment for an insurgency to gain traction and grow. And combined with the nation-building failures, which left a large segment of the Iraqi population disillusioned with their liberators. And, you know, in that summer of 2003, in that long, hot summer, virtually all the military officials I talked to at the time believed there was a window of opportunity to put Iraq on a better track. I think there was always going to be resistance and always going to be more resistance than we thought going in. But I think it needn't have been this sort of virulent resistance. And that's my thesis and assertion in the book. And I actually think it's a viewpoint that is subscribed to by the people who were there at senior levels on the ground in Iraq in the summer of 2003. Now, at this point, I'm going to turn it over to General Traynor, who's going to address what the Iraqi perspective, literally, on the war and the implications of that for both the lead-up for the war and the conduct of the war itself.
Thanks, Michael. General?
Well, Kurt, thank you very much for the hospitality of the House, and to all a happy St. Patrick's Day. What I'm going to do is address what I think is one of the unique parts of our book, and probably one of the more interesting parts, is the view from the other side of the hill. While we were reading the Iraqis, or more correctly, while we were misreading the Iraqis were misreading us. We have to start off with the acknowledgement that most of this information we were able to glean from a classified program that was conducted by the Joint Forces Command and put together from the interrogation reports of the senior leadership of the Iraqi political and military hierarchy, and was called Iraqi Perspectives. And we also drew upon the studies of the Iraqi survey group that looked into the WND issue. I suppose we should start off with an understanding of Saddam Hussein. Everybody knows he was a very nasty man. But I think I would describe him as an egotist, and like most tyrants, very secretive, very paranoid, and a survivor. And survivor, remember that as I go through this. Drawing on some of the POW or EPW reports. This is way, the way one of the senior Iraqis described him. Saddam Hussein lived an illusion. He was so self-absorbed that he believed his thoughts were divine. If he thought it, it was true and correct. Consequently, his thoughts could not be counted with logic. I think that speaks volumes about the man. And the consequences of this, I think, are pretty much expressed in what Tariq Aziz, his number two man, had to say. Saddam was the absolute ruler and was responsible for making all the decisions. Only his relatives would dare to present him with even mildly opposing views. Of course, telling the truth isn't in your benefit. So you could see the area in which people operated. It was an area of enormous fear with this egomaniac. The earliest incident that we came across of significance that kind of reflected this thing was a meeting that he had with his military leaders in 1995. Now, he had been defeated in 91 in the Desert Storm operation. So they were kind of doing the rebidding on the part of the military. And they were coming up with the realization that if you fight an enemy that's highly advanced, such as the United States, you know, they stood absolutely no chance to do this. So one of the proposals was that they would establish a people's army, people's resistance, and they drew the lessons that from the Russians against the Germans in World War II. And the people would resist, and it wouldn't be the regular armed forces. Well, this did not set well with Saddam Hussein for two reasons. Number one, he believed or pretended to believe that the strategy that was employed against the Americans in the first Gulf War was successful, the strategy of defense in depth, where you just draw back, draw your enemy in, and destroy him. And he said, you know, the Americans were defeated at the Euphrates lines because no reasonable person, if they were winning, would have stopped at that point. They would have moved right on to Baghdad and overthrown the regime. Because they didn't, it meant that we were successful and our military operations were correct and that strategy was correct. And now you want to change it? So that didn't go over well with them. The second part that disturbed him was the idea of a people's army, of people rising up against the invader. Well, he didn't like that very much because he saw what happened in 1991 during the fighting, that the Shia uprising nearly toppled the regime. He was shaken to his roots by what happened. Now, what the military was addressing was an external threat, an invasion from outside. And they really weren't thinking of the United States, because the principal external threat from the point of view of the Iranian leadership and Saddam Hussein himself was not the Americans, wasn't the Israelis, it was the Iranians, people right next door, three times their size. They had fought an eight-year war against them, and Saddam Hussein knew that they had an active WMD program. That was the external threat, and that was the one that the military was focusing on. But this was a kind of a useless conference, because Saddam Hussein wasn't focusing exclusively on the Iranians, indeed, not even principally. He was focusing on, as I've said, he's a survivor, he was focusing on the dangers within Iraq, an internal security problem. That is where the threat to the regime came, and he was insistent that they deal with that. Now, being paranoid, he didn't trust anybody outside of his own tribe and his own family, and even he didn't trust them very much. So he made this concession, which is interesting because it's almost a paradox with not having a people's war against an external invader. He established in 1994 under Uday a parallel military structure to the regular army and the Republican Guard. And that was known as the Fedayeen, Saddam's Fedayeen. And these were all loyal Sunni and Saddam devotees. And what they would do would be emplaced throughout Iraq, particularly in the Shia regions to the south, to put down any sort of insurrection, notwithstanding any sort of external invasion, but just to keep these people under control. So they were established in all the towns and villages and cities in southern Iraq, and they were armed with caches. We all know all the reports coming from the troops in the field were these enormous caches of munitions that they found in schools and hospitals and mosques and so forth. But they were put there, none of them heavy weapons, but you know, AK-47s, machine guns, RPGs, for these Fedayeen units that were embedded down there to maintain a control over the Shia population. And on top of that, he put out orders under penalty of death. There would be no bridges blown. And for two reasons. Number one, and of course, as you know, the Mesopotamian Valley has all these, the Tigris, Euphrates, and other water holes that had to be bridged. He did that for two reasons. Of course, he didn't want to destroy the infrastructure, economic infrastructure of Iraq. But most importantly, one of the problems in the first Gulf War was that the bridges had been destroyed by the Americans. And when the Iraqi armed forces tried to come down to put down the insurgency that had broken out in 1991, they were impeded because the bridges were down. He didn't want that to happen again. He wanted the bridges to be in place so that the Republican Guard and others could rush to the scene of the insurrection and support the Fedayeen, who were holding down the insurrection, and then put the insurrection down completely. So we were concerned in the United States about them blowing the bridges. He had no intention of blowing the bridges or blowing the dams or burning up the oil fields. None of that was in the game plan, and I'll return to that in a moment as to why. Now, the other thing that he, given the fact that he looked at the external threat as being Iran and also the internal threat being the principal one, being his own people, we come to the subject of weapons of mass destruction. Now, he had tolerated 12 years of sanctions, which hurt Iraq terribly, virtually destroyed the infrastructure. And you say to himself, well, he didn't have WMD. Why didn't he come clean on that and get the sanctions lifted? Well, he didn't. Again, because of his great fear of survival of the regime. And he wanted people to worry about whether he had WMD or not. And he practiced what General Hamdani, who was the commander of the Second Corps, described as a deterrence by doubt, creating doubt in everybody's mind as to what exactly he had. And he felt that this was very useful for forestalling the Iranians and also for forestalling any sort of uprising on the part of the Shias, because he had already used WMD against the Kurds, and he attempted to use it in the Shia uprising, and for X number of reasons, it didn't happen. But he felt that this was a great deterrent to problems external and also problems internal. But he did not have WMD. He got rid of it all. He got rid of it all. And it was on the 22nd of December of 2002, just a couple of months before the war, that he called his military leaders in and told them that the cupboard was bare, that he didn't have WMD. They were shocked. And I remember it's a compartmented and secret society. People didn't know what was going on, even the leadership. And they were shocked that we don't have a counterforce in case there's an invasion, because the war clouds of an American invasion were starting to gather. In fact, they were rumbling. And he said, no, the cupboard's bare. We don't have anything. And they were absolutely shocked. So you have to say to yourself, well, where's all this evidence coming from? One of the interesting features was, if you recall, Colin Powell stood before the United Nations, and he showed pictures of biological, mobile biological laboratories, and he had tapes of messages that went back and forth from signal intelligence telling people, you know, to clear up and make sure that inspectors would come in, they wouldn't find any WMD because he wanted to keep the UN on his side. And this was interpreted as hiding WMD, but it was just the opposite of that. He was insisting that everybody within Iraq that was involved in the original WMD program was make sure that there was no vestiges that people could find, or the international inspectors could find, that the Americans could use as a casus belli. So there was a misinterpretation on our part for something that was legitimate on his part. Now, how did he view the United States as a threat? He didn't particularly view the United States as a threat. He fought the war. In 1991, as far as he was concerned, the Americans got everything that they needed. You know, oil was flowing. They had a presence there in the Middle East. The United States was not a principal exterior threat, except in the remotest sense. Again, the internal threat was his own people. External threat was the regional threat from Iran. On top of that, he just couldn't see that the United States would go to war against him for a number of reasons. One, as they say, no particular reason to do so from his point of view, the fact that the United States did not have any sort of constituency in the international community that would help him. There was the fact that the United States was casualty adverse, and the idea of them going to war and bleeding. He just didn't think the Americans, you know, could stand losses that would be involved in the war. One of the reasons we was able to stop the Americans in the first Gulf War. So he had this whole litany of reasons, including the fact that the international community would be putting terrific pressure on him, and particularly Germany and France, which turned out to be the case. So he just did not feel that the United States would go to war. But to a certain degree, there was a risk. But then he assessed the risk this way. Because of casualty aversion and the United States' high technology, if they did go to war, it probably would be using airplanes and missiles and so forth, and there would be these strikes. And as he took the position, hey, nobody knows how to accept American air attacks better than the Iraqis. That's not going to defeat us. Worst-case situation was if the Americans did, in fact, come across the border and invade Iraq, they wouldn't go to Baghdad. They would simply settle for the Shia area in the south, and particularly the Ramalia oil fields, take control of those, and then they would stop. And as far as Saddam Hussein was concerned, he could still survive that, as long as he held on to Baghdad and had the Kirkuk oil fields in the north. He could accept the loss of the Shia territory in the south as long as the Americans didn't go any further. So it was an amazing shock when the Americans did attack. Now, as we know, and Michael alluded to the fact that he made use of the Fedayeen, and they were operating under what was known as the emergency plan. They were not under the military. They were under Uday Hussein. And it was a decentralized organization. And it was not designed to deal with an invader, as one of the proposals were for the People's War in the 1995 conference. No. It was a counterinsurgency force. Not an insurgency force. It was counterinsurgency aimed precisely at a Shia uprising. However, the fact is, you know, if an invader comes in, they weren't going to sit on the sidelines. They were going to fight, and they did. And as Michael has alluded to, they became the biggest thorn in the side of our military operations, and became the core then, not that it was planned, became the core of what finally emerged as the post-Saddam insurgency. Well, as the Americans advanced, the entire military organization started to become unstrung. The attacks were fast. Air power did tremendous amount of damage. But Saddam Hussein also inhibited the Iraqi military. He's so afraid of a coup, not only by the Shias, but by his own people, that he kept units, they couldn't contact with one another. The Iraqi army, Republican Guards, who were supposedly probably his most loyal troops, the Republican Guard was reduced to sending out reconnaissance units, which normally in any army go look for the enemy. The units were sending their reconnaissance outfits out to find out where friendly forces were because they couldn't communicate with one another. It was a disastrous, dysfunctional sort of military. The Special Republican Guard, which was these were the most sworn and loyal troops, they had the responsibility for Baghdad. No other units could go in there, whether they were Republican Guard or regular army. Special Republican Guard was the only one that could be in Baghdad. But the Special Republican Guard commander was appointed by Saddam Hussein because he was a cousin, and he was described by his fellow generals as a man who had failed the staff college, was a drunk, and a coward. All the requirements that one would have as being non-threatening to Saddam Hussein. As one, as the the Minister of Defense said, that he was too dumb to create a coup and too stupid and too afraid to participate in one. So that was the guy that was in charge of the defense of Baghdad. As we continued the attack towards Baghdad, overcoming some of the Fedayeen opposition, In December, Saddam Hussein suddenly has this brilliant stroke that we're going to change our strategy and we're going to have a circle strategy, with Baghdad being the key to everything. He had a whole Baghdad, and he was going to have a circle defense. And they came up with an entirely new plan, which, thanks to some contacts that we have with the Germans, we received an outlay of that plan in February of what the defensive plan, so-called circle or ring plan for Baghdad. So I went to Tommy Franks in February, so we knew what they had planned to do. But it didn't mean anything because it could not be executed. The military was not in a position to do exactly what the ring plan called for. But it's an indication that some of the people who vocally opposed our actions in Iraq actually helped us out. But there was another aspect of it. Saddam Hussein and his close entourage remembered Schwarzkopf's move in the first Gulf War. If you recall, it was the so-called Hail Mary or left-wing attack where we were moving up the center and all of a sudden we came around with a left hook. And he became convinced that this is what the Americans were up to, that the attack coming from the south was not the main attack. Why? Well, there were only two divisions, a Marine Division and an Army Division, involved in it. And he knew that the 4th Infantry Division, which was the most advanced of American military divisions, which was the one that was supposed to come down from Turkey in the north, and the Turks prohibited it, where was that? That was really the main attack, that the attack from the south was false, and the attack actually would come from the western desert coming out of Jordan. So at the last minute, when there was the need from an Iraqi military perspective to reinforce the southwestern front, the Euphrates front, against the 3rd Mechanized Infantry Division coming across through the Kabbalah Gap, just when that was essential to defend the capital, he denies the reinforcements and focuses attention to the west, and what reinforcements and units there were started to orient themselves to the west. Not that, again, that it made that much difference because our air power was decimating. So it was almost tragicomic what happened to the Iraqis. Dysfunctional, led by a paranoid, he wasn't a madman, but a paranoid survivor. And to the very end, he couldn't believe that he had been defeated. When you saw that fellow from the propaganda bob, or whatever they called him, talking about, well, the Americans aren't there. He really believed it. The reports coming in from the field, for the most part, were always positive because you never gave Saddam Hussein erroneous reports. It was very similar to what happened with the Germans at the end of World War II when Hitler, was moving around imaginary units and still getting favorable reports from the field. So they were defeated. Hamdani, the man that I mentioned earlier, the commander of the 2nd Corps of the Iraqis, that faced the bulk of the American attack, was absolutely distraught over what had happened. When the Americans came across, busted through at Kabla, and he was out in the, well, he was up in Baghdad asking for reinforcements and permission to blow a very critical bridge, which would slow the Americans down. Finally got the permission to do it, but it was too late. They only partially blew the bridge. Americans were coming across, and he realized the jig was up when he went to his field headquarters, and he found that there was an American M1 tank sitting right outside of it. So he gave up and left and spent 10 days in the wilderness before he finally gave up to the Americans. And he estimated that it was only about 15% of the Iraqi army that actually fought the Americans. But I have to tell you, there were 100% of the Fedayeen that fought them, and then we have the insurgency that followed. I think I'll close at that point, if I may.
Thanks, General. I think what we'll do is go straight to some commentary, and then we'll open it up for questions, just so that we're sure that we hear from everyone. And I think we'll just go along the panel. And what I'd like to do to start off is ask Dennis, Richard, and Michael just a couple of minutes about the book, what your overarching views are. And I'd be curious, as you sum up, this is clearly a book that's not done. There'll be another version probably in a year or two's time. I'd be curious to hear from each of you. Help us write that last chapter. Dennis.
Well, first, this one, right?
Yeah.
Look, it's an extraordinary book, and I have to admit, I read it right after I read Assassin's Gate, so I come here completely depressed. When you read those two books together, it has an extraordinary impact on you. Look, I think that there are some important lessons that have to be drawn from the book. There has to be a pretty good assessment of what was the Rumsfeld strategy, which is spelled out in the book, not only for what happens here, but in the future. Rumsfeld was governed, as you outline in the book, by a strong conviction that there's been a revolution in military affairs, and it has to be applied in terms of how you use force when you're trying to engage in regime change. His focus clearly is using information dominance, lethality of weapons, precision guidance, great mobility, and you don't need to use mass. And you suggest, in fact, if you're going to deal with nation building and what comes afterwards, you have to. I think that the next chapter, as we look at other contingencies, needs to evaluate the judgments you make about the Rumsfeld commitment to this kind of force structure and revolution, and whether or not one has to rethink that, not only as it applies to the kinds of conflicts we're going to be in, but the implications it has for force planning over time, number one. Number two, I think what you do extremely well is outline what can only be described as a kind of faith-based approach to regime change, that everything would fall into place, not fall apart. And here, I think it's what would be very good is to highlight something that you don't quite do in the book that maybe does fit in the next book. I think you're very good, and Michael, you said it, at suggesting that the last war was fought. But it's also the case that the worst-case contingencies for after the war were also the same ones that were basically planned against. In other words, it was we had to plan against and prevent the oil fields from being set on fire. I would just say it was the Kuwaiti oil fields that were set on fire in 91, not the Iraqi oil fields that were set on fire. And because, as you note, Saddam's view was that he was still going to be there, he wasn't going to destroy his own oil. So we were planning against something that was worst case that it didn't happen. We planned on refugee flows because that's what happened in 91 with all the Kurds who went to the north. Here again, we had created a protected area for the Kurds. So where were, in fact, all these refugees going to be coming from? But here again, this is something we're planning against. You're quite right. There was planning done for what would happen after the war. But if you go through each of the areas that we're focused on, some of them were legitimate and understandable. Some of them may have been legitimate but not particularly understandable. And unfortunately, the real worst cases, which were the effects of looting, were not dealt with. You note that there were those who said, look, we need a police presence. We need to plan for this. But in effect, they never really get listened to. The whole what happens, and I guess for the next book, the whole question of what happens when you have a vacuum. If you're gonna, if you're, I don't know how often we're going to be engaged in these kinds of conflicts in the future, given what's happened with this one. But if you get involved and you're thinking about regime change, you better think about what happens once there's a collapse of a regime. As you note, there was a key assumption here that basically everything would remain in place, and all you had to do was come in and be enablers. That was the Rumsfeld view. But in fact, if there's a vacuum, what happens then? And how do you deal with the vacuum? And what capabilities do you have? And how do you enhance capacity? And can you do it from the outside? And are we particularly well equipped to do it from the outside? And if we're not, who can? The notion that there would be Arab forces that would come in ignored the view of, that most Iraqis have towards their neighbors. How would they have reacted to that? I would guess not particularly well. I guess I won't belabor it. There's a series of assumptions that are made that obviously didn't fit the situation, and maybe what that's a reminder of is, since I'm doing a book on statecraft right now, you know, you start with objectives that may be, that may make sense in the abstract, but objectives always have to be refined by assessment. And assessment has to be informed by reality, not by a faith-based view of what reality is. The reality has to be, I think, somehow you create the reality by making sure that you're listening to people who also are raising hard questions. I'm afraid one of the consequences, one of the reasons some of the hard questions weren't raised, is because people raising questions were seen as somehow not believing in what the policy was, and therefore, if they were discredited, then their questions were discredited. But those questions also had to be taken into account. You're not going to be able to face reality and understand reality if you deny reality. And one of the things that comes through very clearly in your book is there's a lot of denial. There isn't acceptance of reality. So if you're going to deal, I think if you're going to get into a situation of this sort, make sure that you incorporate people who represent a range of views, and you do the kind of wargaming that I'm impressed by what you describe as the kind of wargaming that was done in advance. You look at the military's plans, and they're quite impressive. And the military is constantly raising questions about, do they have sufficient forces? I'll close with this. The one question I have for you that I know you try to answer in the book, but I guess maybe I wasn't completely satisfied by the answer. Why isn't the military more insistent on this? They can see what the consequences are, not only in terms of the nature of what has to happen in terms of getting rid of Saddam, but also in terms of what is required for afterwards in terms of securing the borders, securing all the weapons of mass destruction sites, which after all was the ostensible reason for going, trying to create order and ensuring that you have not a situation of chaos, and you have filled the vacuum in a way that prevents anybody else from being able to be perpetrators of violence.
Michael, save that question for a moment. Richard, having been serving at the White House during this consequential time, be useful to offer your perspectives of someone who lived through this.
I had two really big puzzles for me watching this experience in the government. The first, you don't really deal with the book, and that's okay, but it was sort of on the days right after 9/11. How is it that people immediately started thinking about attacking Iraq? And as someone who was sort of a terrorism specialist, it just amazes me when I hear that, because it just doesn't follow. And I know that's not the focus of your book. But it comes up in the very first chapter, and it reminded me of the questions that I had watching that. The second, though, is the focus of your book, which is, why did the post-war planning and occupation go so badly? And how is it that this administration, with such an experienced group of principals, makes so many mistakes? And your book, like others, chronicles those mistakes, and you do a particularly good job chronicling them. But I still have questions, and this maybe is the last chapter Kurt's talking about. I still have questions about why. I mean, why is it that this group of people who were there at the time could make this series of mistakes? I'm going to just offer three explanations, which are a little bit different than the ones that you offer in the epilogue. First, I think the requirements of realistic post-war planning collided with the requirements of building political support for the war. and political support both within the administration, which is to persuade the president himself. And there were those who wanted to do this right from the start, and I can understand, but then the president had to be persuaded. And that took a while. He ultimately was persuaded, and once he was persuaded, Congress had to be persuaded, and a lot of other countries had to be persuaded to at least acquiesce. And my hunch is that the process of doing that really argued against being very candid about how difficult it would be after the war and what would need to be done. And dissent and questions and hard facts and long studies all were the sort of thing that could make it harder to build the political support you needed to start the operation in the first place. So that would be my first explanation. And that was, when you say they fought the last war, I don't think that dynamic prevailed in the last war in 1990-91 to the same extent. I think this was a different dynamic. Second point, in how all these mistakes could be made about the post-war planning. In engineering, the one thing you don't want to create in a mechanical system is what they call single-point failure. And I think we had sort of interagency single-point failure here. We had just an extraordinary concentration of power in the Secretary of Defense without the normal checks and balances that we expect in a functioning interagency process. And you do chronicle this pretty well, I thought. The marginalization of the joint staff, first within the Department of Defense, and their sort of exclusion from some of the planning process. The Secretary of Defense's ability to, as Tom White put it, grind down the combatant commander and get him just to sort of shrug and go along with the preferences. The marginalization of the National Security Council staff here and their exclusion from the planning process and the marginalization of the Secretary of State and his subordinates. And so you got to the point where all the big decisions, which were not, they weren't strictly military decisions, were really concentrated in one man and in a building which he had by then submitted, to his will. And so this is the sort of thing that we really want to guard against in the future to ensure that when the president is getting advice on massive, major decisions like this, that it reflects the view of all his advisors and that power and authority and information is widely shared among the people who get it. And it seems to me that wasn't happening to the extent it should have. You know, Goldwater Nichols really reaffirms in law this notion of unity of command. And that, I think, is exactly right for tactical issues and operational issues in the field. But when you get to what is essentially a political military issue, or to use Dennis's word, statecraft, unity of command is a problem. It's not that simple. You can't have it be quite that. The third point, and I don't think this comes out enough in the book, frankly, of why these failures were made, is this was objectively a really, really hard task. And I was impressed, frankly, with Jerry Bremer's book on this, when he just talks about, here's a guy who was essentially uninvolved in the war decision and planning, shows up one day and has to take over with a couple weeks preparation, and he catalogs all of the problems he has to face. And they're unbelievable. I mean, it's astonishing when you think about how hard this task was. And one of the theses in the book, Michael and Mick, is, I'll read it, I was really struck by it. There's a direct link between the way the Iraq War was planned and the bitter insurgency the American-led coalition subsequently confronted. And I think that's right. There is a link. I don't deny it. But I think there's a stronger link between the ethnic geography of Iraq and the bitter insurgency and between the Saddam history in that area and the bitter insurgency. And I think if there's criticism I would offer about the book, is I think it downplays a little bit the impact of that history in Iraq, and perhaps exaggerates the impact of the mistakes we made in the post-war planning and occupation effort. I don't doubt that there were mistakes, and I don't doubt that they had a role, but their relative weight as opposed to what were the facts on the ground when we got in there, I think, might have been a little bit misplaced. Last point, Kurt. There is a sense in this book that transformation of the military was oversold a bit. And I worry about that. I worry about taking too much from that. Clearly, the post-war planning and occupation was mishandled. But the war itself was a pretty extraordinary event when you think about it. I mean, you took as you know, we can dismiss them however we want, and I think the information you have about the Iraqi strategy is terrific. But this was the fifth largest army in the world, and it was defeated effectively in 3 weeks, with hardly any air campaign beforehand, with one division less than even the planners had counted on, because the fourth wasn't available from Turkey. This was a fraction of what the military conventional wisdom was beforehand, of what it, and they did it. And it's pretty extraordinary. And it says a lot, I think it validates a lot of the ideas that were in the President's Citadel speech in 99 and that Secretary Rumsfeld carried through. And clearly, those lessons should not have been carried over into the post-war occupation when you did need mass. But it was a remarkable success, and I hope that that we don't take a lesson out of this experience, which says that transformation was a mistake or was oversold, and that we do, in fact, continue down that route for our own defense policy.
Thank you, Richard. Michael?
Thanks, Kurt. It's an honor to be here discussing this brilliant book by two of the great military historians of contemporary America and such an important conflict, and it's an honor to be speaking in front of people who have been involved in this. Been great comments so far, and I just want to add a couple, especially given that I have to admit I haven't finished the book yet. When I got it Monday afternoon, I thought of calling my buddy Kurt and saying, Kurt, there's only one way guys like you and I can find the time between now and Thursday to read this book, which is to book a flight to Japan right now and just go and then come back. But I'm delighted it's actually this thorough, and I will look forward to finishing it in the days ahead because the military history piece of it is going to be such a big contribution. But I'm going to, as others have, talk more about the specifics on the policy debates and just make a couple of observations. One, in trying to understand how we could make some of the mistakes that we made, and Richard's done a nice job, I think, of reminding us of the successes and the mentality and the inherent difficulty of this. But still, there were some big mistakes, and I like to think of it as the failure to do a good job starting on April 9th was really the flip side of the same logic that led us to such a brilliant success. One didn't have to follow from the other, but Rumsfeld fell in love with his war plan. He fell in love with a plan that said, go for the head of the serpent, cut it off, and the rest of Iraqi society should be intact and should be something we can work with. Because I think it was the right war plan to try for. Michael Gordon did a very nice job of saying there needed to be a plan B. But it makes sense that in such a corrupt dictatorship that you would try to go for the head of the serpent. And it made sense, given all the CIA contacts and other special forces efforts that we had made, to hope the conventional army might not fight that hard. And in fact, we had some success in keeping the conventional army largely out of this fight, and largely because they didn't really support the regime for all the reasons and with all the implications Michael had talked about. There were all these multiple layers of security. The conventional army was many layers removed from Saddam, not great loyalty to him, not part of his inner circle, not permitted inside of Baghdad. There was no particular reason to think they would want to fight, and therefore every reason to hope that maybe, just maybe, they would survive the war and be willing and able to restore security for us once it was complete, once the invasion was complete. So the same logic that I think led to this fairly smart invasion strategy on balance, despite the problems with the Fedayeen that Bernard and Michael had talked about and which are very real, that same logic led us to believe that we had figured out a way to minimize the resistance from Iraqi society writ large. And I think that was true. But the problem is you couldn't count on the institutions surviving. And that's obvious in hindsight. It was also fairly obvious, frankly, at the time to me and most others on the outside that you needed a plan B. But I could still see how working so hard to come up with this new invasion plan, which flew in the face of a lot of traditional CENTCOM thinking, and frankly, Rumsfeld did a good job of challenging some traditional military brute force concepts of needing 500,000 people. A lot of the revisions Rumsfeld made in those 6 to 12 months leading up to the war, or I guess 15 months leading up to the war, were fairly smart. The problem is he didn't have time to get into the details like that if he was going to ignore phase four as a result. And there wasn't enough benefit to doing it to ignore phase four as a result. But I think some of the logic of what he was doing made sense and was validated by the success of the invasion. The problem is that in doing that, working so hard to do that, he sort of became enraptured by his own plan and believed that it would work in a way that it only could be viewed as an aspiration. So cutting off the head of the serpent, nice idea, drive to the heart quickly, nice idea. Maybe the Iraqi security forces, like the conventional army, will survive. Good idea, but the huge mistake was counting on that happening and not having the plan B that Michael Gordon talked about. So I think that that was, to me, that's how I understand in the book, rightly or wrongly, if I've understood it correctly or not, has reaffirmed this thinking in my own head that Rumsfeld worked so hard to come up with a very good first half of the plan that he became a little infatuated with his own clever thinking, which was pretty clever, but only went up to the April 9th, 2003. That's my take on some of the broad strategy. I want to talk a minute about the Fedayeen in the South. And I think this, to me, is one of the big, maybe to me, the single most important new ground the book's breaking so far in what I've read of it and in what I've read of the broader Iraq literature. Because we all think of the Iraq insurgency, and I think President Bush rightly describes it, as having three main components, foreign jihadists, former regime elements like the Fedayeen, and then the fence sitters, the people who weren't necessarily going to fight, but who chose to over time because things didn't work very well, because they were sort of mistrustful of us to begin with. They were loyal to their fellow Sunni Arab brethren. Almost all these fence sitters are Sunni Arab, especially since Sadr and his forces have not been fighting as hard since the summer of 04. And a lot of the thinking so far in the Iraq debate, I would summarize as saying, if we had only gotten off to a better start, the fence sitters would have stayed on the other side of the fence. They wouldn't have become so discouraged. They wouldn't have been as frequently unemployed. They wouldn't have been as angry at us for doing these culturally insensitive cordon and sweep operations or for efforts to put down the insurgency early on that led to civilian casualties and bred more resentment. A lot of the literature has done a nice job pointing out that that group of fence sitters might have been much smaller if we had gotten off to a better start in the immediate post-invasion period. What I think Michael and Mick have done, in addition to validating that argument, is to talk about the former regime elements in much more detail, with much more vividness than we have realized up until now was possible, and actually point out that that group also might have been diminished in size a great deal. And to me, I've always assumed that the jihadists sort of came later, and the fence sitters were fence sitters, but the Fedayeen and the other top regime loyalists were basically going to be an inherent part of this insurgency no matter what. And as Rich has said, you're going to have a tough mission, therefore, to some extent, no matter what. Now, I think Rich is correct. This would have been tough. But what Michael and Mick have argued now is we actually could have gotten a lot of these Fedayeen before we even marched on Baghdad or before we completed the war or before they had a chance to flee the South. Perhaps that's the most important point. And if we had had follow-on forces of sufficient number and strength in order to follow up and exploit our opportunities, we wouldn't have had to make this choice, which turned out to be a Hobbesian choice, between continuing the drive to Baghdad and letting these forces stay largely in place, except for the ones we took out in the course of just moving through the key passes. And so I think it would have been tough to foresee this. It would have been tough to know the Fedayeen were going to fight this way. I think Mix essentially acknowledged this. It would have been tough to have good enough intelligence to have this all in the battle plan in advance. But if we had had more capacity, more people on the ground, we could have actually devoted some of the units, the 1st Cav or the 4th ID or others, to essentially taking out the rest of the Fedayeen to the extent possible in the south at the same time as the 3rd Infantry Division and the Marines kept on moving to Baghdad. And perhaps half of that, who knows what number, but maybe half of that Fedayeen element could have been destroyed in place. If that had been true, there was even more of an opportunity to squelch this civil unrest and this insurgency in the early months than I myself had appreciated before. I think it would have been very hard to do, again, because the intelligence would have had to be exquisite, or you would have had to been quick on your feet and reacting very well. But we do have very good officers in the U.S. military who are good at thinking on their feet. And I think if they had had the capability and the capacity to do some of this without having to sacrifice the quick drive on Baghdad in order to do so, they might have been somewhat successful. So I've unfortunately become even more critical of the war plan after reading the parts of the book I've gotten through, because it strikes me that of those three big groups that make up the insurgency today, the core Saddam loyalists actually might have been in a place we could have more easily targeted them at a moment in time, and we didn't do it. And therefore, instead of having to fight 2,000 or 3,000 of them to make up a number, we have had to fight 7,000 to 10,000 of them. And that number, plus all the fence sitters and the jihadists, has allowed this insurgency to just plateau at a fairly high level of violent effectiveness. One sentence on the next chapter of the book, Kurt, I would simply say they published the book at exactly the right time, because the next year is going to be more of the same. It's just going to be the Iraqis hopefully having more of the responsibility to win this than we, but our responsibilities are obviously going to remain quite robust for a long time. So it was a perfect moment to publish, because I think the next couple of chapters of the next couple of books written are not going to look that much different than what we're reading in the newspapers right now.
Thanks, Michael. If I could ask some folks that like to ask questions, please approach the microphones. We'll take a couple, and then we'll go to book signing. While you're gathering yourself at the microphone, let me ask General Trainor Michael Gordon one specific question. I have to say, I went back and read the opening part of The Commanders, and it was striking about how you described this generation of military officers that had survived Vietnam, that had arrived on the scene, and that put their bold mark on this war plan. And when I read that and I looked at this book, I wondered if you debated with yourselves about calling this, rather than Cobra II, the Civilians' War, in contrast with the Commanders or the Generals' War, given the dramatic role, frankly, and I would say overriding role, that a number of powerful, determined, decisive civilian leaders played in the formulation and execution of the military strategy.
Let me address that from somewhat a different angle. If I were about to write another book after having done the General's War and this book and having 40 years of service in the Marines, I'm not about to write that book because my wife would be guilty of justified homicide. But I think I would look at what has happened to the American military leadership. Elliot Cohen, of course, did a book talking about, you know, civil-military relations with case studies. But I think we have to look at this. The U.S. military was deficient, the senior leadership, in this war. They did not push back hard enough. There is the culture within the U.S. military to make your case before your boss, and when he makes a decision, you say, aye, aye, sir, and you go out and do the best you can to carry it out. I think that's dodging a responsibility. And I think that we have to take a harder look at what we expect of our military. The military had a pretty good read on this whole situation from start to finish. And having gone through 2.5 years of research and study and discussion on this, I think the military, the solution or the result of this war, regardless of the legitimacy of going into it, would have been a lot better. But they didn't. They didn't do that. There are all sorts of reasons for that. But you have to say to yourself, you know, they swore to defend the Constitution. They have a responsibility. There is civilian leadership. But something is now lacking within the U.S. military. Whether it's the result of the Defense Reorganization Act of 1986 and the Goldwater-Nichols Act, which kind of emasculated the corporate wisdom of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, whether it's that or whether it's the business of you can't get selected for senior rank, or particularly service chief or chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, unless you're a team player, I don't know. But there's something fundamentally wrong, and if we don't take a hard look at it and correct the military culture within the constitutional obligations that they have, then I think we're going to have trouble down the pike again. This is a classic case of the military being ignored and the military not standing up sufficiently, and the end result is what we saw. We had a precursor of this also existed in the Vietnamese War. Military leadership and its responsibility is more than a process and more than an organization chart. A lot depends upon the blokes that are in that chart. And I'm not so sure that we have a sufficiently robust system to ensure that the genius that exists within the military is allowed to express itself.
Let's take both questions, and then we're going to unfortunately cut that off so that we can actually get down to business at hand, which is to sell books. So if I could ask both of you to present a quick question to anyone on the panel, and then we'll return to hors d'oeuvres and drinks. So.
Thank you. David Heyman from the Center for Strategic and National Studies. I want to follow up on this because I think this is really the central theme here that we need to work on. If intelligence was the shortcoming getting us into the war, the civil-military relations was the fundamental shortcoming as we entered into it and going forward. And I want you to talk about the lessons learned. We really hear about the concentration of power with the secretary. We hear about the perhaps the lack of influence by the NSC. What do we learn from the civil-military relations that you can talk about? How do we get it right going forward? Because really this is fundamental to our ability to prosecute military actions in the future. And I don't think it's general, I don't think it's just the military side that needs questioning. So I'm interested in your comments on that.
Yes.
Hi, James Rosen, McClatchy Newspapers. I just wondered if we could try to look forward a little bit, and if two or three of you could say where you think we're going. Are things as bleak as they sometimes appear, and can President Bush's vision of the future be salvaged?
Quick answers from each of you. Michael, let's start.
On the civil-military front, obviously I think that I agree with the comment earlier that the Defense Department had an undue degree of influence and responsibility. But it was President Bush who decided to give responsibility for the post-war to Secretary Rumsfeld and actually signed a directive to that purpose. So this was a conscious decision by the senior commander-in-chief to organize events this way. I don't think we should forget that. Rumsfeld didn't steal the post-war responsibility. He was given that by the president. There were military officials who were given a lot of authority in the war and made their views known, but in the case of General Franks, he pretty much accepted the paradigm that Rumsfeld laid out, which is that that you could get in and out quickly, and it was on his advice that plans were drawn up to withdraw most of the forces by September, and President Bush went on an aircraft carrier and declared an end to major combat operations. So it wasn't a voice that was stifled. It was a voice that was it was heard, but it was within, the accepted paradigm. I'm not sure I have. I think that, I guess two thoughts I have is that, in his exit interview, and we have this in the book on page 39 because I had to look it up, is that in his exit interview with President Bush, Secretary of State Colin Powell told the president that the national security process was broken and dysfunctional. And I think there are any number of examples in that. And I think that the people who, I don't think it's impossible to fix. I think it's a rather easy thing to fix. There just has to be the will to fix it. And that means you have to include different perspectives within your administration. And if you look at the way this administration, I'm not trying to take a political stand, but the one person who had reservations about this war and cautioned about it to a certain extent is not a member, at the senior level, is not a member of this administration, Secretary Powell, and the people who have been retained by the administration, the people who are with the program. I think it's an easy thing to fix if there's a will to fix it at the top. As for the future of Iraq, that's beyond the scope of the book, and I don't have any great insight into it, but I do feel that at this stage it's more of a political, depends more on the internal politics of Iraq and Khalilzad's efforts to forge an internal concession than any military solution. I think the era of the military solution is long past.
General, you get the last word, about 2 minutes.
I'd like to address the first question, because in my previous remarks, I was talking just about the military. But the question, we have a very dysfunctional system here. We operate under the National Security Act, which was basically an act that was put up in 1947 to deal with the Soviet peer competitor threat. And it focused on the military, and it focused on intelligence. But the world that we deal with today is entirely different. But the National Security Act, although it's been amended, is not amenable to it. Now, there's somebody here in the audience, Michelle Flournoy, that is far more knowledgeable on this subject than I am, but we have to be able to better integrate the interagency process. There's a lot of lip service paid to it, but it just doesn't happen. And when the push comes to shove, the problem dumps on the military for the military solution, and they're not always the best prepared to deal with it. So my basic recommendation is that we go back and write a new National Security Act, which would take into the fact that the world that we live in today is far different than the world we lived in 1947.
Thank you all very much. Let me ask you, yes, let's... I know I speak for General Traynor and Michael Gordon, how grateful they both are for you turning out for this big launch. Please stay and wish them both well individually, and they're going to move immediately to that table, and we've got books for sale, and they're going to be signing, and we'll bring them sustenance that will keep them here for a while. Please enjoy yourselves, and again, thank you so much for coming, and thanks to our panel.